Okay, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Soleri Report. I'm very excited to welcome back the Saker. We have much to talk about, as you can tell from the headlines. And Saker and I have been setting lists back and forth of what we want to talk about. And events just keep adding to that list. So Saker, thank you so much for taking time out of what is an amazing website and schedule to join us on the Soleri Report.
Thank you so much for having me. It's always a pleasure.
Well, Russia is in the news. There's a lot to talk about in terms of what's happening in Russia, both domestically and internationally. Where would you like to begin?
Your pick. There is indeed so much to pick from that I mean, we could discuss it from any facet.
You've had a couple of really great pieces on your website, and I was reading one by Dmitry Orlov about the collapse of empire, and we're going to call this Soleri Report The Unraveling, because it's clear the unipolar world is unraveling and the empire is unraveling, or many respects of the empire are unraveling. We'll get to that. But one of the things they talked about is how centralization is happening globally, and the financial stress is happening globally. It looks, you know, it pops up differently in different places, but you can see it everywhere. There's some great comments there. And I think, why don't we start, because both the United States and Russia are grappling with significant financial problems as a result of the baby boomers moving into retirement. And I know you've been tracking for years the pension reforms in Russia. So let's start domestically and look at the pressures on Putin and the Russian government to deal with the pension crisis.
Well, first of all, I would completely agree with you that there is an unraveling happening. And I would recommend an article by Michael Hudson in the Ins Review. He wrote an article called Trump's Brilliant Strategy to Dismember the U.S. Dollar Hegemony. He talks about the dollar hegemony, but I would even say overall U.S. hegemony is really the empire is really cracking at all its seams, and the list of setbacks that and self-inflicted wounds that the empire is inflicting upon itself is quite amazing. Now, in Russia proper, about the pension, this is an internal problem of Russia. It still is an action of the old what I call legacy. Some people call fifth column. Other people speak about, I use the term Atlantic integrationist. There is still a very strongly pro-Western segment of the Russian elites, which is pushing typical kind of reforms that you would see from what we could globally call the IMF types. And they are getting Putin gradually in trouble. They tried to change the reform system in Russia, and the backlash was His main consequence for that for Russia is that for most of the years of when Putin was in power, much of the opposition was hopelessly pro-America, and there were people who were defending the 1990s or who were associated with the Yeltsin years and the apocalypse of the 1990s. Now what we have appearing in Russia is an opposition which is basically still pro-Putin. It's an opposition that would call patriotic in the sense that it tries to do what's best for Russia, but it's an opposition that's becoming increasingly critical of a lot of Russian actions. And the pension reform is something that actually hurts Putin in the opinion polls. There's no doubt about it that he has huge personal credibility. He had it for years, and this time it really took a plunge. His reaction to that entire project, because he was on record saying he was opposed to that reform. Now he says it has to be done. Now, I'm not an economist, so I cannot, decide whether Russia needed that reform or not. But what I can say, it was presented in a way that was not convincing enough. It was presented during the summer, it's just time of break, which, looks suspicious. It looks like it's done when people notice it the least. And I certainly think that the government did not anticipate the strength of the reaction against that reform, which most Russians oppose, by the way.
Can I just point one thing out? In Russia, I believe the life expectancy, that they've moved for men, the date of when your retirement kicks in is after the date of life expectancy. So basically what they're saying, particularly as to men, you don't get a retirement. You get to work your whole life.
Yeah,
Is that
absolutely. And
correct?
second,
Yeah.
yes. And secondly, there's another aspect is that that kind of reform has a risk of creating unemployment because people would try to offload older employees. But the problem with that is that unemployment in Russia is absolutely not sufficient to survive. So, and there's plenty of money in Russia. I mean, really, there was just recently, I constantly see articles coming out describing how the Russian economy is doing pretty well. And the majority of people in Russia are not convinced that this is the way to go. And keep in mind that Putin specifically said during his pre-electoral, he wrote a number of articles on the Russian economy, and during his inauguration speech, I think, he said that Russia is a social state. Now, in Russian, the word socialny is not the same as socialist, socialistyski. However, it still implies that the government has a responsibility for the welfare of the people, and it's not a pull-yourself-up-by-your-bootstrap kind of society. That goes
right.
very much against the tradition of Russian collectivism, which existed before the revolution, during, and after. So this is really something that's bothering a lot of people in Russia, and it's hurting the government, no doubt about it, and it's hurting Putin, too.
Do they see the relationship between whatever the driving economic forces are before, connected to this reform with the big sort of step up in building weapons?
No, because the military budget in Russia is actually pretty small.
Right.
And the new weapons that were developed within that budget. And for instance, specifically yesterday, there was a meeting between Putin, Shoigu, and Lavrov, and they were discussing how to respond to the U.S. withdrawal from the INF Treaty. And one of the arguments was made to deploy hypersonic weapons, land-based hypersonic weapons in Russia. And Putin specifically said, fine, do it, but do it within the budget. That is no,
right.
Russia, I think, learned painfully the lesson of the Cold War, and Russia will simply not match dollar for dollar. So military budget is not much of a problem in reality.
Right. Well, the U.S. uses the military budget to basically buy political support. And as a result, it's basically become wildly uneconomic. Every time you think it can't get more uneconomic, it does. You know, it's a spiral up in terms of expenses. The more money you spend on buying everybody into the tent, the bigger the overhead gets. And so the next year, it just gets more and more expensive.
And, it might sound strange for people in the West to hear that, but the U.S. military-industrial complex is far more corrupt than the Russian one.
Right.
And its primary goal is to fill pockets. I mean, that's why I always say that the F-35 program is a stunning success. It's absolutely not a failure. It did exactly what it was supposed to be doing, which is get, billions of dollars of taxpaying money to specific groups of people. Well, in Russia, not only is, per dollar spent, does the military industrial budget provide much, much more than the American one, but on top of that, this talk of war in Russia is still something that you hear on TV on almost daily basis. And if you look at the type of military reforms that is taking place right now, particularly in the conventional level, it's pretty clear that Russia is prepared to fight a major war, and the popular opinion is supportive of that.
Right.
So again, just to illustrate that the military budget, I don't think, of course there are people who complain about it, but that would be typically that old opposition, the pro-Western,
right.
the kind of Chubais or, Soros, National Endowment for Democracy sponsor kind of people. But this other, what I call the patriotic opposition, is absolutely not making an issue of the military. They support the military
gotcha.
To the hilt.
Okay. So I've always said the difference between Sun Tzu and von Clausewitz was the bond market. And what's interesting is Russia has very little debt. And as a result of what happened in the 90s, it's been essentially denied access to the bond market for the most part. And the result is it's had to come up with sort of an equity system for financing the military. And as a result, it's much more economically capable of fielding a real war.
Yes, absolutely. And not only that, but Russia continues to buy gold in huge amounts. Now, you tell
right.
me why is that taking place?
I think we know. They're
oh,
trying
yeah.
to do something much more self-sufficient. And what's clever is that I think they've used the sanctions to do more, to build much more self-sufficiency. So,
absolutely.
Right. And clearly they have plenty of problems. I think the demographic problems. So I don't mean to make light of the problems. But let's turn to the international. So first, let's start. I want to get to the missile treaty because I think that is the most important thing that our subscribers need to understand vis-a-vis Russia. But let's go to the Ukraine and talk a little bit about what's been happening in the Ukraine, where things are.
Well, the things in the Ukraine, it's nothing new what I'm going to say now, are really, really bad. But they've been really, really bad for a long while now. What we see is that the elections are clearly, there's an upcoming election in the Ukraine. That election results, that upcoming election results in an inflation of grandstanding and Russophobia and hysterical, you know, statements and silly operations like that sending of a couple of ships under the Kerch bridge. The same thing about the Orthodox Church in there, the government, which by the Constitution is supposed to be involved in religious matters, obtained, with the blessing of the Empire, of course, completely illegal in terms of Orthodox tradition and canon law, now at obtaining what's called azacephaly. Basically, a new Ukrainian Orthodox Church was created, which has absolutely no real basis and no legitimacy in Orthodox tradition. All these things are really bad signs. But then again, they've been bad for a long while. I mean, there was a real risk of war this summer. There still are rumors of, you know, they're constantly making statements, the Ukrainian politicians, how they want to deal with Russia, et cetera. It's an inflation rhetoric, which I find extremely dangerous. What is certain is that there's no prospects whatsoever right now of any kind of solution to the Ukrainian problem, and things are just going to get worse. The only question is, how will they get worse?
Well, if it continues to deteriorate economically, and if you look at the economic global economic stresses, I think that's likely. You know,
well,
how?
Just yesterday, I've seen a report about Ruslan Ostashko that the Ukrainian auto industry for the past year produced exactly one car. And that one car was just to test the technology. So, I mean, you have entire segments of the economy which are gone, completely
right.
Gone.
Right.
Shipbuilding is another one. I mean, basically anything of there are a couple of things still working by inertia, but pretty much I would say the Ukraine is a complete failed state. I mean, it's a done deal now. And it's very dangerous because of that.
Right. And if, you know, if I understand correctly, I think the Russians have tried very hard not to end up being economically responsible for the Ukraine. In other words, they don't necessarily want the Ukraine if it means they've got to underwrite the Ukraine. Is that fair to say?
Oh, absolutely. I would even say that Russia can absolutely not afford, you know, even if the Ukrainians, you know, all together, the entire nation stood on its knees and begged the Russians to come in, they wouldn't do it because, you know, even Crimea is hard to support for the Russian economy. And Crimea has huge prospects for the future. So there's going to be a return on investment. The Donbass is also a burden on Russia. I mean, the rest of it, no way. The Russians didn't
right.
create that mess. They feel they didn't create that mess. They will act politically, and they would, you know, of course, they would agree to some kind of international rescue package to jumpstart the Ukraine, but that only once the Nazi junta is gone. They would never deal with them as they are today. So, no, Russia
right.
will not want anything to do with that. They're going to say, as those who did it should pay, you know, primarily Germany. Because the Americans are not going to pay, but Germany and the rest of the EU, they're going to have to pay if they want. If they don't want to be flooded by more refugees and have a, you know, major violence on their borders.
So let's talk about what I think of, I call it in my mind, the great encroachment. For many, many years, the United States, and it's all administrations, so it's, you know, it's the Clintons, it's the Bushes, it's now it's Trump, have been steadily, and I would say it's the Harvard Corporation, have been steadily encroaching territorially in terms of you know, moving missiles, trying to move missiles in and around Russia. And, of course, the Ukraine was part of that great encroachment. But we now see the missile treaty with Russia basically torn up. Can you explain the missile treaty and what this means and what's happening?
Yes, the treaty covers weapons that are between 500 and 5,000 kilometers in range. Basically, these are weapons that if you deploy them in Western Europe, they can reach Russia, and from Russia, they can reach Western Europe. Now, the problem is a fundamental asymmetry here. The weapons are American, but they're deployed in European territory.
Right.
So what that means is that those weapons would be able to reach Russian strategic targets inside Russia, and with new technologies, with both cruise missiles and ballistic missiles becoming faster and faster, the flight time is even shorter than it was during the Cold War. And the equivalent Russian missiles would not be able to reach the United States at all. They would be capable of reaching Western Europe. Now, here's the deal. The Russians fully understand that in case of war, the United States is not going to give a damn about strikes in Europe. I mean, that's totally not comparable to strikes on your national territory. So from that point of view, that treaty was very important for Russia. On the other hand, that treaty limited only ground-deployed weapons, so you could still have them on ships and on aircraft. And Russia now has free rein to deploy missiles on the ground, too. So I think it's a really bad idea that the United States basically did that, I think, primarily for financial reasons, but also for reasons of political posturing. The Trump administration is basically withdrawn from pretty much every treaty it can think of by now. That's just the latest one, and to prove that, the entire MAGA propaganda. But it's actually very destabilizing because that treaty was fundamentally addressing this asymmetry. Now that if the weapons are deployed, which is by no means certain, first of all, the United States might think twice about doing it. Secondly, there is some hope that Europeans might say, fine, the treaty is abrogated, but we're not going to allow the deployment of these systems on our national territories, which would take care of the problem. But what is certainly going to happen is that we're seeing a full spectrum increase in an arms race. And if the U.S. is fighting that arms race primarily with dollars, the Russians are fighting it primarily with technology, it still is an arms race. So it's by definition undesirable, and it's the opposite of a confidence-building measure. It just increases tensions and risks. So it's a disaster, really.
Except for the people who make the weapons.
Absolutely, that's it.
Right.
It's primarily a disaster, really, I think, for the Europeans, who are going to have more crosshairs painted on their cities now and but they've been doing that for a long while now by deploying the USABM system. I mean, the Europeans are just, like lemmings. They're acting in a completely suicidal manner, not heeding their own basic security interests. And the United States is using that for financial reasons, as you said correctly. Russia can and will reply to it, although specifically Putin said that it's going to be entirely mirroring its actions. That is, right now it's the U.S. declared that it's withdrawing. The U.S. is declaring, that Russia is declaring the same thing. If the weapons are ever deployed, Russia will deploy her own weapons. Russia has no interest for that arms race whatsoever, but she, I think she can deal with it, technologically speaking and financially. I think.
Well, the reality as a financial, I mean, the it's important to understand the relationship between money and force. If you allow guns to be put at your head around your territory, then you're going to be controlled economically. I mean, that's the reality. So this is about who controls Russia and who governs Russia. It's not about weapons. In other words, weapons really just translate into political control and economic control. So
I also think it's posturing. I really believe that this is posturing for the internal consumption, and very much that's the way of pinning the Europeans. The more the Europeans, let their territory become a territory on which the U.S. can deploy its forces, the less sovereignty the Europeans have, which is exactly what the United States wants, is to not have, sovereign Europeans deciding for their own interests.
So we see the Europeans set up a special purpose entity so they can maintain the Iran deal and people can transact with Iran through the special. So building a workaround SWIFT is a major chink in the reserve currency system. So to me, that's not an inconsequential thing because that's step one to really moving around SWIFT. And we know the Russians have built a SWIFT alternative. So those are big steps. But the other thing we see Macron and Merkel talking about an EU defense capability, how serious is that?
Oh, it's absolutely not serious whatsoever. NATO is big in terms of money, in terms of equipment, but It is pretty, you know, it's an open secret that the only NATO army capable of fighting would be the U.S. I mean, the rest of them are pretty much a joke. Morale, training, everything is extremely low. You know, the French and the Germans have been discussing some kind of common defense for decades now. There's nothing new. So first, I doubt it's going to happen. If it's going to happen, it's going to be a fictional thing. Europe is falling apart even faster. And you see that politically disunity. I mean, right now, Italy just voted not to allow a joint EU statement in support of Guaido in Venezuela. That's just another sign of how weak really Europe is. NATO, look at the problems with Turkey. Really, for all practical purposes, you know, NATO is more of a political entity. And in military terms, it's the U.S. It's just a one-man show. Even the Brits are in really bad condition now.
Italy just keeps surprising me. I'm going to be there in March, and I can't wait to talk to people because every time I turn around, Italy's like, whoa, what's going on? Somebody's rational in Italy.
Yes, not only that, look at the movement of the yellow jackets in France is extremely dangerous and serious for the government. It's tremendous staying power. And I believe the Italian Prime Minister said that in Italy, the yellow vests or jackets, how you say it in English, I'm not sure, are already in power. He considers himself part of that. So, you know, with the Brexit on top of that, with the tensions between the two big ones, France and Germany, and the rest of Europe, the tensions between, you know, with Hungary, with Poland on different issues, the EU is in terrible shape. The immigration problem hasn't been solved whatsoever. So, I mean, everything is falling apart. It's cracking at the seams.
Well, but here's the thing. The EU, you know, the current political structures don't work, don't make sense. The EU never made sense. But,
correct.
But if you look at Europe itself, the infrastructure, the life, the culture, it's so much better than it is in the United States. So, you know, the transportation system, certainly in Northern Europe, work phenomenally. I mean, even I travel in Europe a lot, and Europe relative to the United States is the, you know, the day-to-day life of most people is far superior than it is here. So, you know, when people say Europe is falling apart, I would say the culture and the life is not falling apart. Now, it's certainly being stressed.
I'm not so sure about that. First of all, there are a number of things that are still, I think, much, in terms of quality of life, much better in the U.S. Cheap housing being one thing for a lot of people. Actually, I would say civil rights. There still is a First Amendment in the U.S., which, you know, is attacked from all sides but exists. There's no such thing as a First Amendment in Europe. The immigration crisis in Europe is infinitely worse than what the United States is suffering in terms of immigration. I mean, the Europeans would love to have the kind of immigrants the U.S. has and trade them for what they have as immigrants.
Right.
I think the social and political tensions are much stronger and much more overt. The United States, the problem is that it's a monolith and that basically political dissent is being very effectively suppressed here. Europe being much more diverse, it's harder to suppress it. You suppress it in one part, it appears elsewhere. You know, I mean, there's nothing really profoundly in common between, say, the Catalan separatists in Spain and the Gilets Jaunes in France or Brexit. But all these things do have an underlying common thing. It's that they're specific to specific locations inside Europe, which makes Europe much more fragile in many ways. So I don't know if it's better in Europe.
Well, Europe doesn't. You know, Europe does not have the advantage of the American landmass. There's no doubt.
Yes.
You know,
another example. You mentioned, for instance, transportation. I agree. In the United States, public transportation is horrible. But then again, if you look at France, for instance, you know, you have very good trains bringing people from the center of the city to the suburbs. But if you look at crime on these RER, they're called, it's just actually huge. The Americans would never stand for that level of violence. That's what's taking place in the Paris suburbs now. You know, the crime is really, really rampant there.
Right. Well, in America, everybody buys a gun and takes care of it.
Agreed. And in Europe, all they do is you know, pass anti-gun laws, even in countries which traditionally, like Switzerland, were very much allowing people to arm themselves. It's absolutely true. So there are things, you know, I mentioned the First Amendment, you mentioned the Second Amendment. So really, the U.S. is lucky to have these amendments.
Right. So I think it's very, you know, if you go place by place, I think you need to get very granular. It's hard to generalize. Europe is a big place. The United States is a big place. And so it gets very particular to where you are and very local. So let's talk a little bit about Syria. Bring us up to date on Syria and what has happened in Syria.
Well, I would say in Syria, the main event is a comprehensive collapse of all the U.S. plans there, and I would argue all the Israeli plans there. And recently, Hezbollah Secretary General Hassan Nasrallah, had an interview with a Lebanese TV station where he said that basically every single objective that the Israelis had completely collapsed over there. And which brought the Israelis to do some pretty crazy things, including shooting down that, they didn't shoot it down directly, but they hid between a Russian aircraft. And as a result, a Russian aircraft was down and its crew perished. And the Israelis were given an opportunity by the Russians to sort of save face, and they didn't. Instead of that, they doubled down. So now they've really spoiled the relationship with Russia. Is getting worse and worse and worse, which is not good for Israel at all at a time when the U.S. is getting weaker. And in Syria, the Russians have now deployed air defense systems, which are actually being very effective, contrary to what people say. They mention Israeli airstrikes on different occasions. But if you compare the quantity and quality of the airstrikes since the deployment of these systems to what it was before, it's actually fantastically effective. It has dramatically reduced the Israeli options inside Syria. And all those Israeli airstrikes are really pinpricks. They make no difference, militarily speaking. These are all, frankly, I think they're Israeli psychotherapy. They're doing that to just feel good and still... No, it really is. They're trying to prove to themselves that they're powerful.
Right.
Governments do that. It's the same thing as Michael Ledeen saying every couple of years we need to throw a small state against the wall to prove that we mean business. Both the U.S. and the Israelis engage in, they're in complete denial about their weakening, so they engage in political maneuvers and even military actions, which are designed as a psychotherapy to feel better, to feel powerful. It's the Israeli version of MAGA. But it doesn't
right,
mean
to
that
send
actually
a message.
On the ground, they're losing. They're losing everywhere.
Right. 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 To a certain extent, it's part of the media effort, and they've forgotten what's real and what's entertainment.
Absolutely. That's the crucial thing. And the Israelis and the Americans know that fully well, that the reality on the ground doesn't matter. The best example with the Israelis, the defeat that they suffered at the hands of Hezbollah is one of the worst in military history. It's embarrassing. They still declare that they won. And as I remember, George W. Bush said, you can deny the most basic facts. I think it's one of the, Chris Hedges speaks about an empire of illusion. It's really true. It's a core feature. And that's why I always recommend my friends, don't listen to statements of American politicians anymore, because they're so out of touch with reality that they're meaningless.
Well, but that's the goal. Is the goal to win the war, or is the goal to win contracts that drive the stock market up and generate campaign contributions? Because the more you lose and the more you can then justify spending more for equipment, et cetera, the more money everybody makes. In other words, it's back to the downward spiral of because in many of these situations, I think the goals are not to win the war on the ground. That's not their goal.
Well, I think we have two different levels here. There is most definitely a huge economic component. the entire U.S. military-industrial complex and the armed forces, their goal and they're structured to first and foremost bring in money to corrupt politicians and, CEOs. But at the same time, I think on a political level, the empire is cracking on all levels, and I think the U.S. expression is that with somebody with a hammer, everything looks like a nail. They're doing what they're best at, and that's how they cope with every problem, which is lie and deny. And so even if the typical example is, Trump sending three aircraft carrier battle groups to the DPRK in the formidable armada, I think he said, and then nothing, absolutely nothing. Grandstanding about Iran, nothing after that. Grandstanding on Syria, nothing. And now I think it's going to end up, it's still too early to call, but I kind of feel that the empire is going to completely fail in Venezuela too. Maybe I'm wrong.
Oh, but here's Trump's
situation.
If you go, I'm going to go back to what I said in 2016. Trump's goal is to reshore to North America. And part of pulling back and reshoring into North America is to try and keep things going long enough to get your self-sufficiency much significantly increased. And so it's, you know, you're bringing up a new system while you're trying to keep the old system going. And it's a bit of a shuffle. Do you know what I mean? It's almost a bit of a con game. But
Well, I'll tell you frankly, I mean, I am not a mind reader. I'm not a psychologist. I don't know what Trump thinks. But I will tell you that my personal conclusion, having observed his actions before the elections and then after, I don't think he thinks anything. I think he basically can be reduced to, he's trying to appease the neocons, and he'll do whatever to do that. The problem with that is that the neocons, besides being fantastically arrogant, are also fantastically incompetent and ignorant.
Right. So they can't be appeased. They can't be appeased.
First of all, they can't be appeased. Right. Secondly, what they're making Trump do is so terminally stupid that it ends up hurting the U.S. So my big fear is that Trump is what I call a disposable president, which is the neocons hate him because they can't forgive him the fact that he defeated them at the election. They took control of him now, and I think they're going to use him to do the dumbest, most crazy things that their ideology, you know, mandates them to push forward, such as recognizing, Jerusalem. While at the same time, if things go wrong, they're going to blame it on Trump and say, look, this guy, he was always so bad. We were always opposed to him. So get rid of him and put us in power. And, you know, somebody from the Clinton gang or somebody else that the neocons approve of, some Rahm Emanuel or whatever, will be replacing him. It's a very cynical ploy on their part.
Right. So I'm more cynical than you, but I want to deep dive into this. Because if you look at what Trump has done in the last year, basically what it looks like. So let's look at reality. Trump has basically moved a Bush guy into running the Fed. He's moved a Bush guy into the Supreme Court while he was doing it. FASB Statement 56 went through, which is basically an obscure accounting policy that says the government can have secret books and authorize secret books in the contractors and private companies and banks that do business with them. So they've just taken the entire securities market dark, and that was snuck through with the approval of Congress and the White House during the Kavanaugh hearings. So another Bushie goes into the Supreme Court. Then they announce that they're taking one of the great leaders of Iran-Contra and putting him in as Attorney General. So he's going through another Bushie. And now you have Elliot Abrams, another Bushie, coming in as the special hitman on Venezuela. And as Trump walks out of Bush's funeral, he gives a thumbs up to W. So basically what you see is the whole Bush gang moving back in and taking control of the machinery. So what it looks like to me is not just that Trump has made a deal with the neocons. That's clearly happening. Trump has basically embraced the whole Bush syndicate.
Yeah, but I think in the case of the Bushes, and even going back to Reagan, I mean, we saw the neocons really come to power, but they reacted to the election of Reagan by infiltrating gradually a lot of conservative circles,
right,
think tanks, institutions, et cetera. I mean, I personally witnessed that. I was in Washington, D.C. from 86 to 91, and I even had people, you know, I cannot name these guys, but they were, you know, running think tanks who were telling me that they're describing how the neocons are taking control by first financing them, then putting people on their board, then changing the directors. I mean, you know, the Heritage Foundation wasn't always that, for instance, neocon as it became since, and many other institutions like that.
Right.
And then during the Clinton years, we had a huge coming out where it was. So I think they are present in both parties, first of all.
Right.
And they're using what I would call the Bush faction of the neocon party now, because that's what they have in the Republican Party. But if the Republicans lose power and, you know, the neocons manage to put a Democrat in power, it's going to be the same neocons, maybe different faces, but fundamentally the policies are going to be the ones we have now. I mean, they did it to Obama. Obama wasn't a neocon choice initially, and then they managed to turn him around. So they're very, very good. You know, the Americans beat them. The American people beat the neocons in elections, and the neocons beat the American people after the election inside the White House.
Right.
That's how they operate.
Right. And what's hard to understand is, you know, the quote from presumably Karl Rove and Paul O'Neill that says, you know, you're reality-based and you're just going to watch us. They're not bothered by reality.
No, they're not.
They
not at all.
Just keep, right, they just keep you know, and I love Charlie Ferguson's documentary on Iraq because it shows you the neocons going in and basically destroying the whole civil infrastructure in the country on the theory that their team can get more contracts, sort of rebuilding it. And they don't really care that what they're doing won't work because they don't care about reality. They have their media machine that can, you know, sell the latest. It's almost like they're running a reality TV show with lots of, you know,
I completely agree with you. And that's why I always bring the example of the orchestra on the Titanic that played, you know, music while the Titanic was sinking. That's a typical neocon thing to do. I mean, the latest what I heard, I don't know if it's confirmed, but I read yesterday that U.S. is planning on building two more aircraft carriers, which, considering the changes in cruise missile technology and in missile technology generally, that's just about the dumbest thing you could possibly do.
Here's the thing. You know what, if you were going to do, if you were going to double any part of the budget, I would assume you would double the special forces budget. You know, you would double what you're spending on people or their training. You wouldn't spend any more money on big stuff, but big stuff is what generates fees for your friends.
Yeah, absolutely.
Why would we buy more F-35s? It doesn't make any sense.
Well, it makes lot of sense. It has no military purpose, but it makes a lot of sense in terms of filling your pockets. We're seeing exactly the same thing at work. I mean, most of U.S. procurement right now is totally disconnected from military needs or any kind of, you know, normally force planning goes through a cycle, right? I mean, you first you define a national strategy, objectives, you look at the threats, you look at the means of potential enemies, you look how you can counter that. This is not happening anymore in the U.S.
Okay,
what now is basically an inflation of grossly, obscenely expensive budget items. You know, two aircraft carriers, I rest my case. That makes the F-35 look reasonable.
So I would say that the U.S. and the planet are dying of a privilege addiction. And that addiction requires the generation of huge amounts of fees for your friends by a whole variety of mechanisms. And as long as the bond market and the reserve currency can finance it, the addiction appears to just get worse. And the people who are addicted will use any means, you know, necessary, overt or covert, whether it's covert war or overt war, to feed their addiction. And they're like junkies. Now, I've never been able to understand the neocons. I've never been able to understand them. But one of the things I'm convinced of is to feed their addiction, they're prepared to destroy America. And so the only way you stop and put them into withdrawal is when the bond market financing their addiction won't do it anymore.
Well, first of all, I completely agree with you that they are the single biggest threat to this country, and they are destroying it by their absolutely insane policies across the board. I completely agree with you. Where I would differ a little bit is you're just saying the entire planet is, you know, suffering or collapsing because of that. I think that what Russia and China are doing is rather than confronting the hegemon directly and trying to bring down, you know, the IMF or whatever else you want to name, they're building an alternative. Like the SWIFT example is a good example. You know, they're not using some kind of means to try to, you know, dissolve and bring down the SWIFT. They're just building an alternative. And that's what I think most of the planet will start doing more and more and more. And that's probably the biggest danger for the empire right now. I mean, for instance, another example is look what happened in South Korea. South Korea used to be an occupied colony which had no say whatsoever. And when Trump got completely crazy with the DPRK and the risks of war were very real, the previously very subservient South Koreans suddenly contacted the North Koreans and start doing bilateral discussions, which ended up basically defeating the U.S. position. Again, we discussed Italy. That's another example. I mean, what's happening is that gradually, one by one, you know, the blocks that form the empire are falling out.
Here's where I just don't agree, because you're talking as if the Anglo-Zionist empire has a cancer, and if the empire dies, the cancer, you know, dies with it. And what I see is the globe has a cancer. It is most, you know, it is doing the most damage through the Anglo-American empire. But I think the reason they had a financial coup in the 1990s is they didn't think the empire would last. And they wanted to suck out all the money. And so that when it, you know, when they finish squeezing it dry, they'd be ever more powerful. So I think the cancer metastasizes into something far more dangerous.
I would agree with your image, but I would just change one term of it. The empire has a cancer, the U.S. has a cancer, and so does the planet. But most of the rest of the planet is gradually becoming aware of the identity of that cancer. Whereas in the U.S., the propaganda machine is such that, while a lot of Americans are actually aware of what's going on, there's a good reason why the people who voted for Trump said, you know, we want our country back. But they don't have, basically, if you're a U.S. citizen, you have no means of doing something about it.
Oh, yes, you do. Yes, you do. The ballot's, well, the ballot's, I would say, is a tool, but it's a minor tool. The U.S. people have a lot of tools they could use, and they haven't wanted to use them.
You know, like what?
So the whole weak position of the federal credit mechanism is that it all depends on people buying treasury. It depends on individuals buying treasury. It depends on their banks and insurance companies buying treasury. It depends on their pension funds buying treasury, and on and on and on. And the stock market depends on the same thing. And the reality is the American people have many different mechanisms through the money to basically shut off the funding or hold the funding accountable. And they haven't used them, but they're there.
But Catherine, for that, and anything dealing with the market and people taking action in the market implies information. And
right.
In the United States, there's such a crackdown right now on alternative information. We see that in the social media and generally against the blogosphere, that people are never told about that.
So I'm going to be a bad guy now. And
okay.
I'm going to tell you one of the hardest things I had to understand in the last 20 years. So I'm going to ask you a theoretical question. If I sent you an email and in it I had a paragraph description of how every woman could have as many orgasms as she wanted, and another paragraph with how every man could have as many erections as he wanted, and I sent it to you and I said, under no circumstances, you know, this is confidential, share it with anyone, how long would it take for everyone in America to have a copy of that email?
I don't know. What do you think?
A month? The reality is people in America are afraid. They don't understand the control mechanisms.
Correct.
And what they know is that generally people who fight the machine get hurt. And there are thousands of ways the machine has covertly, because control in this country comes down to 3,100 counties. And they control people, one person, one family, you know, one county at a time. And you're up against a machine that's a one-way mirror, because the intelligence agencies have, you know, and the systems have phenomenal ability to do surveillance, and they have the power to kill with impunity, and they do all the time. You know, but they have lots of other tools too. And the, you know, most people have believed that their bread was buttered by playing ball. But the reality is, you know, if you look at what's coming, I won't even say it's coming, because Saker, it's here. It's right now. It's this year. If you look at what's going on in the U.S. bond market, the money is finally starting to not work. And that means that this machinery that can buy everybody into the tent can no longer afford to buy everybody into the tent. And people are having their contracts abrogated on them, whether it's their retirement contracts or their business contracts. And so people are starting to turn. And the question is, will they exercise the tools they have available? And it's kind of like, it's dangerous to do it by yourself. It's not dangerous if you can get enough people organizing a crowd. And that's the question, how can we organize to do that? And you're going to have to look at the money. Now, I've been yapping about $21 trillion missing from the U.S. government for, you know, more than 20 years publicly. And now it's starting to catch on, because people are finally beginning to realize, oh, you know, if I can steal $21 trillion, then I can do whatever I want. And there is money. There is money for pensions. There is money for roads. There is money for water systems, you know, but it's being stolen. So I have to deal with this, because there are no solutions unless I deal with this. So, you know, the tools are there to do plenty of things, but it's going to take some courage.
I think I really disagree with you. And I'll give you a couple of reasons for that. First of all, the example you gave is very telling. I mean, you spoke about women having orgasms and men having erections. To understand that message, first of all, it caters to profound instincts. Secondly, it's very simple to understand. You know, you have a problem and you fix it. You know, you can't have an erection, use Viagra, and you can have it again. That's simple. But if instead of sending two paragraphs like that, you send two paragraphs on economic issues, most people won't even bother reading it because it doesn't address profound instincts. And secondly, there's a level of competence to understand these issues. Right. It's made worse by another phenomenon, is that good information is mixed in with absolute nonsense. We've seen that very devastatingly used against the 911 truth movement, where next to, you know, world-class scientific research, you have a lot of idiotic theories, you know, about directed energy weapons or God knows what else.
Well, disinformation works.
It works very well, and what happens is people are confused at that point. They know that they're being lied to. I mean, the perfect example is, say, for instance, modern medicine. The vast majority of people I speak to realize that, you know, modern MDs are pill pushers, that diagnostics are botched. I mean, it's a terrible condition. It's controlled by the pharmaceuticals. But then you look at alternative medicine, you know, 80% of that is solid, you know, kookery entirely. It's nonsense. So people try it out of despair, and then they end up being disgusted because nothing works. So people, I think, are really confused. Again, I don't think it's a matter of courage. Right. When the American people have a possibility to try to do the right thing, or, you know, change you really believe in, or a more modest foreign policy, or get their country back and make America great again, every time they try to exercise that, and every time they're betrayed by the people they trusted.
Right. But here's the thing. You cannot solve the problem by electing somebody to the presidency. You have to solve the problem, because the money is stolen one county at a time. The 3,100 counties, the money is stolen one county at a time. Everybody can deal with their county because they drive around, they see it, they walk around, they see it. And so the way you shift the money back is you shift it one county at a time, 3,100 counties. Now, when they're willing to do that and go, and you don't need everybody, because in every county in America, and it's every county in the world, 10% of the people are what I call sort of high-performance people. They get more energy than they take. 10% are the opposite. They're the slugs. And 80% just follow whoever is in charge and is no more capable of dealing with economic information. But if you take, you know, I've seen it because it happened here in my county. We had a sheriff who was, I would say, walked on the wild side. And people got mad and put in a good sheriff. They were up against major disinformation, major effort to stop it. You know, but they all, it was that 10%, about half of that 10% put down their foot and they said, I've had it. We're going to assert adult supervision. And sure enough, we got a great sheriff. Makes a huge difference. So you don't need the average American to grapple with any of this. You need in every one of 3,100 counties, and you know, you can start with just 100 counties. You need half of that 10% to decide, okay, we got to do something. It's exactly what happened in Port Allegro with participatory budgeting. The townsfolk got together and said, this is in Brazil, you know, we're going to have to take charge and the, you know, everybody involved is going to come in and do the budget together. And you're going to have to get in, you know, and the solutions are all going to be mathematically described and oriented. You know, how many people do we have? What are our resources? Okay, how do we make sure everybody gets fed? How do we make sure everybody gets water? And you go from there. And that's what's going to happen. And it's going to happen, you know, it can happen nice or it can happen rough. But you're going to have that 10%, some part of that 10% decide, okay, you know, we got to clean up the dirty money in this county. And you're seeing it happen all over the country. There, Cheryl Atkinson just did a great presentation on a group in Montana that cleaned up the health system there, and it's a perfect example of what I'm describing. And they were able to do the impossible because, you know, otherwise you were going to have the state employee health system go bankrupt, and the state employees were not going to tolerate that. And they had enough power within the government to get it done. So, and, you know, the pharmaceutical companies and the insurance companies just had to eat it.
I think there is going to be a lot of what you describe, and it's already happening in many ways. People do react. But as soon as their reaction becomes big enough to fall on the radar of, you know, the federal government and the deep state and neocons, the people involved get either corrupted or destroy their reputation. The media describes it as kookery, and they start, you know, basically opposing it. In the empire of illusions, reality doesn't matter until it's big enough, and they're not going to let reality become big enough as long as they can. That's why I personally think
that
the shock will come from outside. I don't see, any chance of change coming from within the country. I think it's too late. I think they built a pretty close to perfect system. But the outside shock is something that they can't control. That's where I see it, because basically reality outside their sphere of direct control, that's, it matters, and the illusions don't. The illusions are what wins the game.
Right. So outside shock can come in two ways. It can come through the bond market on the financing, or it can come militarily. So we have a central banking warfare model. So the shock can come through the central banking system, or it can come through the warfare system. So my question to you is, if it comes through the warfare system, how will it come?
Well, that's my big fear. I do not think that the leaders of the empire are deliberately going to start a war against Russia or China or any kind of country that can really present a major threat. However, it is possible that they get, they can slip into a situation where it rapidly escalates.
Right.
And I think that any military operation, even Venezuela, first of all, I doubt the United States are actually going to try militarily to intervene in the country. But if they did it, Venezuela presents very serious risks. The other countries on the list, of countries that need to be crushed, i.e. Iran, China, Russia, or Syria, for that matter, forget it. They can't do it. So right. They would be, if, for instance, I've been saying for years that if the United States actually attacked Iran, they would lose that war simply because there's no way of winning it. So Iran wins by default. And in the case of Russia, if it ended up being a war, I think the risks of it turning nuclear, strategically nuclear, are very, very high. At that point, the empire is gone simply because the Russians will wipe it out.
So let's turn to Venezuela. For years, I've been trying to figure out how much of the downward spiral in Venezuela is coming from Chavez's reforms not being the right package versus the shunning by the basically Langley sanctions and the Anglo-Zionist financial system, basically trying to tank. So how much of it is an economic hit coming from outside, and how much of it was Chavez reforms just not working?
I am not qualified to have an opinion on that. I hear contradictory things from very expert people. I'm about to publish an interview with Michael Hudson asking exactly that question. I think it would defer to him as to how much of that is due to mistakes and ideological policies, as some people say, or, massive sabotage. What is clear to me, at the very least, is that considering the oil reserves of Venezuela and the need to get some kind of victory, which is also very important. I mean, the U.S. was defeated. So far, Trump has been defeated in the DRK, Syria, Iran, Russia, China, everywhere. Maybe they're trying to show that they're still powerful inside, the former Monroe Doctrine territory, and throw a Venezuela against the wall. But to allocate blame for the economic situation there, I'm simply not competent to do that.
Several years ago, when we got serious reports of people basically starving to death in Venezuela, I spent several hours online trying to figure out a way to send money to people in Venezuela or to donate to somebody who could get the money, and I couldn't do it. It was amazing. You had a complete embargo. It was quite extraordinary, and of course, nobody was saying that or writing about it or telling about it.
I mean, to be honest, I think it's likely, although again, I'm not competent to say whether this is correct or not, but it's likely that mistakes were made. I have friends in Venezuela who were very much pro-Chavez and who were really irritated by some of the stuff that was happening inside the country with, his local political supporters, and apparently corruption is just as bad as it was when he came to power, and making full circle back to Venezuela. Look, the Venezuela, they had their money in the UK, their gold in the UK, and their money inside the United States. How wise is that? I mean,
that
probably, again, I'm not an economist, but I think that those who criticize Chavez and Maduro for having mismanaged a lot of things, and that includes, by the way, Russian economists, are probably, it sounds credible to me, even though I'm not, again, I'm not competent to really say it either way.
You know, one of the things I want to touch on again, because to me, the issue of culture, whatever I'm talking about politically these days, I always come back to culture, because without the culture that can, you know, you can't have law unless you have a culture which is committed to having law. And where you have hypermaterialism, you get corruption. You know, where you have Christianity or very strong spiritual and moral cultures, you get something better.
Mm-hmm. And, I agree.
You know, one of the things I continually wonder about is the effort to drive a wedge between Russia and the West to stop the Christians from getting together and asserting a moral culture on the planet.
Yeah, but see, I really think that's, I mean, the West, the way I see it, it's really post-Christian. And there are still Christians in the West.
Right.
But, you know, quantity has its own quality, and they're not enough to be relevant in a cultural civilizational term anymore.
Right.
Christianity is actually, I would argue, persecuted in the West, really, for and, you know, or it's, you know, complete fake Christianity with very little in common with the faith that would used to be called Christianity. So, and even in Russia, you know, we shouldn't, I know there's definitely a religious revival. People turn to religion and, you know, Christian ethics. But it's not, you know, people who truly live by that is not a majority either.
Right.
So Russia in some way is also a post-Christian society that is now looking for its roots. And I wouldn't say it's a done deal there. There it's still a moving target. It could go either way. But in the West, I don't see any chance for any kind of Christian revival. For individuals, yes. For small communities, absolutely. Why not? But in terms of entire societies becoming Christian again, I think that's absolutely impossible. At which point, it makes no difference to separate Russia from the West or not. And I think Russia and the West have been separated by over 1,000 years now. So I don't see what's happening in Russia will not, you know, spill over into the West. I don't believe that either.
So I want to step back and talk about, you know, as you know, I love your books. And your first book was a shock because I asked my assistant to print it out. I didn't realize how long it was. And I ended up with this huge pile of paper on my ottoman, and I would read it at every meal and just laugh until I cried. And one of the things I loved was you describing leaders in Europe, including France, who really understood what was going on. You know, they had both a marvelous understanding and a marvelous sense of humor. And I thought about it the other day because to Macron's credit, he got out into the street and started walking around and talking to people. And it was fascinating to watch. I don't know if you watched any of it because I realized he doesn't understand. He has no idea what's going on bottom up in the economy. You know, he's been, you know, he's an attack poodle. He was a poodle. He's been groomed and raised. And he really doesn't know, you know, that it's not a meritocracy. He really thinks he worked his way up and it's a meritocracy. And he really doesn't understand the covert side of the economy. And I realized, oh, this is really dangerous because you've got so many of these people who, you know, they're fine if the machinery is working and it's not unraveling. But in an unravel, they have no idea how to navigate because they have no clue how the system really works.
That's absolutely true. And in France, there's a real risk all it would take in France is enough of the police and security forces to say, you know what, we kind of, and it's already happened and locally.
Right.
They're
going
to support the protesters, at which point, you know, this is France. I've always been saying that a revolution in France is an absolute possibility, and they're a shock, anything. Things could go south, say a violent confrontation somewhere or something happening with the security forces. I mean, Macron is in real, he's in danger. And the people behind him, because really he doesn't matter. You correctly said he's a groomed, you know, he's the kind of, the French version of Guaido, same deal exactly. You know, puppet figures that have a specific look and they're supposed to bring through the interest of a specific ruling class in France. That ruling class is panicked right now. because it's very hard, because what they usually do, they either, two options, either you, you know, you infiltrate and take control of the opposition or you discredit it. And for instance, the ruling class in France did a marvelous job taking the unions under control. Well, the unions are not controlling the protest whatsoever now.
If you look at the Yellow Jackets, that 10% I was talking about, you know, there are a lot of that 10% in those Yellow Jackets.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes, and there's not one leader. This is very important. So there's hard. It's going to be hard to decapitate that movement. I thought it would peter out just because of, it's been, what, 12 weeks already or what? You know, I thought it would eventually peter out, but it seems to be still going, to my amazement. So the level of rage in France is extremely high.
Right. The people in that movement, you know, this gets back to the productivity backlash. The Yellow Jacket includes a lot of the productivity backlash because you have lots of people who know what it takes to make the economy go, and they know the centralization and the pushing everybody into the cities is not economic. So they have the knowledge. You know, it's interesting that in many ways France is much better set up to, you know, shift the money and the funding, specifically because I think you're right, they can get the enforcement side to support them. Let me turn to the U.S. elections. We already have the 2020 election is off and running. And Tulsi Gabbard is someone that you and I have both paid attention to. Now, I don't think the president of the United States can get a whole lot done. You know, so if change is going to come, it's going to come 3,100 counties at a time. If it does, then the president can do more. But I do believe it always matters the quality of the people you have in every position, no matter what. So tell us about Tulsi Gabbard, because you followed her a bit.
Well, the key word is here a bit. I mean, I only look, first of all, obviously I like her. I like the way, what she says. I mean, her trip that she went to meet Assad. And she has a lot of things going for her. I like her. However, she's already backtracked on at least one issue, which is homosexuality. And that's just because she announced, you know, that she's running now. What's going to happen when the pressure, I mean, how is she going to make money, first of all? And secondly, look at the reaction on the Democratic side, and particularly the neocons. They're absolutely trying to destroy her. Well, they did it to Trump and didn't prevent Trump from being elected. So that might not be a showstopper, but I don't think, first of all, the system, I don't think, can reform itself by political means in the U.S. anymore. Second, I don't know that Tulsi Gabbard would have the courage and the staying power to resist the huge pressure on her. And finally, if she makes it to the same White House that Trump did, you know, look what it did to him. Is she going to be so much stronger than him? I think it's going to be interesting to see what happens. And again, I like her very much. But would I pin any hopes on her? No.
No. So my read of the financial coup is they stole enough money to buy America, to buy the government, to buy everything. And now the question is, you know, what's their plan? And clearly their plan is, you know, Fortress America. But what else it involves, it's hard to say. So let me turn to the last thing I want to talk about, because I love your website. I love the articles. I love the – you have an incredible collection of people writing for you, but you also have the most fabulous debates and dialogues with the articles. So, you know, I was printing out some of the articles to prepare because I want to take the material into the den to read it. And, you know, and the discussions go on for much longer. If you print out an article from the Vineyard of the Saker, you get a very long, you know, you use up a lot of paper. Anyway, but your website is an extraordinary community of people and things, and I'd love you to just describe it a little bit.
Well, I'm really happy that you mentioned that, because all the credit goes to the moderators. My website, I'm always accused of, you know, of censorship, and they say that the website is
That's
heavily
so
moderated.
Funny.
No, but actually, there's a lot of truth to that. It is a website which the comment section is very strictly moderated. And I think the moderators, you know, none of them are perfect. They might have a mistake here and there, but they are the ones who did a superb job, in my opinion.
The only thing I've ever seen censored is bad manners.
No, this goes more than that. I mean, there's a list. I actually have moderation rules, and it's getting longer and longer. It's really bad manners. Whatever makes it a conversation. The comment section, some people either close down the comment section because they get desperate, because you get trolled, and you get, frankly, a lot of idiots and nutcases. I mean, that's what we forget. Right. The internet is the perfect platform for expression for crazy people. And some of them are amazing. I'll mention one. I have a guy that's been on my, you know, blacklist that is never going to be published for years now. He typically on an average day, he tries to post 4 to 10 comments on average.
Uh-huh.
He's still at it. He deserves credit. I mean, he hasn't been published a single time in years. He's still trying to publish. This guy's clearly a nutcase. And so you have a solution. Either you shut down the comment sections or you make it a free-for-all, and then it's guaranteed going to be hijacked by a group of loud, obnoxious people who have nothing else to do. So unfortunately, if you want to have a good conversation, you have to have strict rule and strict enforcement of that rules. And some people resent it as a censorship. I am actually deeply grateful to the moderators who, in my opinion, are doing a superb job.
They do a very good job. And the debate is free-range and wide and... You know,
but, you know, they never get thanks. It's very rare that somebody says anything good about them. All they get is complaints and criticism, which is grossly unfair because look at the alternative.
Oh, I think they do a fabulous job. And the proof that they do a fabulous job is how many people are showing up to discuss.
I agree.
So it's all in the performance. And people don't show up and invest time in discussing, debating. You know, they don't pour their intellectual capital out unless they feel like there's safety and there's rules and there's law. You know, the rule of law really does work. So
I'll give you an example. For instance, some people, they just cut and paste from another article. That's banned on my website. You can quote an article if you want, but add your own thoughts. But if you're just, you know, posting a link or, you know, quoting a paragraph from an article, you won't get posted. That's a simple thing.
Right. Well, all I can say is it works. And I do want you to describe your books as well, because I have to tell you, if you want to get when you live in North America in particular, this is not true for the folks who live in Asia. You know, Asia, you're basically involved in lots of other cultures and countries, same in Europe. But when you live in North America, whether Canada, the United States, you tend to live in a bubble. And you don't get the richness and the vitality and the complexity of the multipolar world. But when you read your books, it gets you out of the bubble and into that complexity in a really delicious way, because there's so much that's fun. It's pretty... Even no matter how dark you get, it's very, very funny. And
on a third book, actually.
Oh, really? When? I'm looking forward to this. When can I have it?
it's my problem. I'm the one keeping it back. I'm too slow on it. But it's going to be big. I mean, the original draft was 1,000 pages. We're trying to reduce that now.
I don't mind. I don't mind. Well, I know it's expensive to publish, but I don't mind.
But it's coming up, but it's going to be a third one sometime this year, God willing.
Okay. Well, we look forward to it. Tell everybody again what your URL is and how to find you and how to support you.
That all can be done on my blog, which is thesacreinoneword.is, as in Iceland. And you can get the books there. The first one is for free download. You can order the second one, and you can see all the articles and my weekly analysis are all on there. So that's the place to go.
Yeah, check back, because it's pretty – there's a lot of vitality. There's a lot of that chuck full of nuts energy there. Anything else that we missed that you want to describe? Anything we forgot to talk about? Any last words for your many fans?
No, I think we've covered the main ones. I mean, there was so much to cover that we sort of, you know, took a bird's eye view of it. But I think we've covered the main places where it's happening. I think, obviously, the next big thing now is Venezuela. Because clearly the tensions worldwide are major over that. And let's see how it goes. I am uncharacteristically, and maybe mistakenly, but cautiously optimistic, actually.
So,
I think it's so ridiculous that maybe it will flop also.
So there's one thing I forgot to ask you. So maybe since we brought up Venezuela, I can just ask that one thing. If I was going to pick a person as a special envoy, if I was the president, I was going to pick somebody who everybody in Latin America would know and loathe, it would be Elliot Abrams.
Absolutely.
So why would you want to pick someone that everyone that would unite all of Latin America against you?
The explanation is the word neocon, the way they think, the way they're completely detached. I mean, their level of arrogance, condescension, stupidity, hubris is just absolutely mind-boggling. It's the worst guy. I mean, if I had spent 10 hours thinking who the worst possible person would be, I would have picked him. Really?
Well, here's what's so interesting. I don't know if you remember.
It's a slap in the face of every single Latin American. It's a slap in the face.
So you know, Tillerson had put forward Abrams forward as a potential deputy, and the White House had rejected him.
Yeah.
So the turnaround on Abrams is, I find, you know, I can only explain it by a deal with the Bushies. That's the only way I can explain it. But I still find it a remarkable reverse marketing on the part of the U.S. administration. I just can't fathom it. But
that's yet another one of those Trump white flags where he says, you know, one A and then does the opposite polar non-A, hoping to appease the neocons, which are not going to be appeased. They're just going to be even more empowered.
Well, what was it that Schumer said? He said, Trump will learn. You have to do what the intelligence agencies say.
Yes. Yes,
there he did. Go.
And he's right.
Okay. Well, Saker, I can't thank you enough for everything you're doing. Keep doing it and let us know how we can support you at the Saleri Report.
Well, at the website, that's where you can do that. And thank you so much for having me. It's always a pleasure.
Okay. You have a great day. Bye.
You too. Bye-bye.